Hello and welcome to another episode of Art and Labor. We are the podcast that covers the ongoing struggle to survive as an art and or cultural worker. Man, it's been a while.
Yeah.
I'm OK Fox.
And I'm Lucia Love. And we've got guests again for you.
Would you guys like to introduce yourselves?
My name is Stella Becerril, and I am a freelancer of many kinds of media work. And I'm also one of the organizers with the Freelance Solidarity Project that's now part of the National Writers Union.
And my name's Haley Melodic. I'm a freelance writer and editor. I'm also an organizer at the Freelancer Solidarity Project, now part of the National Writers Union.
For those who haven't heard, the Freelance Solidarity Project opened up applications. So anybody can fill out the criteria or the questions and see if they would fit in the union and just join. I'm sure you guys have a whole frequently asked questions page on your website, but what people might not know is that it's open to like any type of freelancer, not just writers. Do you guys want to talk more about like, you know, our show is kind of focused on visual arts, but like reaching out to all this like diverse group of freelancers and how that those conversations happened?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, we can definitely do that. So, you know, I think one of the things that we realized in the process of doing this, you know, most of the people who I guess formed part of the original team of people organizing, which I was not part of. I came onto the project in November. And when I came on, most of the people in the room were writers or journalists or, you know, the editors. They focused on in the writing world. Their work is focused in the writing world. But slowly, new members started to show up and say, well, you know, I used to do some writing maybe, but now I do more illustration. Or what about my friend who's a freelance photographer? Or, you know, do podcasts count? Where do we fit into this stuff? And so that presented an opportunity for the project to talk about that. Like, what does it mean to be a freelancer in the larger media landscape today? Especially since most people have had to develop themselves in multiple skills. Yes. In order to just piece together a living, right? So you've got people who are illustrating and are writing and are doing podcasts and are doing all sorts of different media work. And and we wanted to make sure that the umbrella that, you know, we created with the Freelance Solidarity Project would represent the interests of all media workers. And so that definition is still, I guess, sort of like expanding. Some of the majority of my work today comes in the form of freelance styling for commercial photo shoots. Would that fall under the umbrella of media worker, right? I think so. I think everybody else in the project thinks so. But, you know, sussing out what that looks like, what, you know, the struggles on a commercial photo set for Victoria's Secret, for example, might look like versus.
Yeah. And like as like these lines between like native advertising and like other like more traditional writing are being blurred, and like, you know, platforms like are like social media platforms are like monetized in like similar ways as media. It's like, because I feel like wardrobe stuff used to kind of be like more in the film and TV umbrella, which have some strong union presence, but like very like kind of different. But like now it's like, yeah, why not? It is like you're styling for like,
well, like, yeah, fashion, yeah. Editorial work also has right, a totally different economic structure, where a lot of it will just be like, hey, come on, don't you just want things to look good?
And Haley, when did you get involved with the project?
So I've been involved through the Writers Guild for some time now. I was an editor at MTV News when we decided to organize with the Writers Guild. And Stella brings up such an important point, I think, about how the industry demands media workers to develop many different types of skills. When we were organizing that union, we fought really hard to make our bargaining unit editorial production, right? To make sure that it wasn't just the writers, but also the editors, the copy editors, the social media people, the video people, the podcasters, like graphic designers, everybody, because so many of them, not only did they have the skills to do many types of jobs and do them very well, in my biased opinion, but they were expected to, right? That they would be paid for one type of work, but then, you know, every writer was expected to appear, if not develop, their own podcast. They were expected to appear on camera. And so that really informed a lot of my thinking. And I think we were at MTV at a time where we were seeing that happen at a lot of other digital-based media publications.
Okay. You don't want them to just, like, pivot to video, right?
Oh, God. I will never escape that phrase. But, yeah, and so after we were, like, the majority of the staff at MTV News at that time was laid off just over 2 years ago. And then shortly thereafter, you know, there were layoffs and buyouts of publications like GMG. And, yeah, like, it's just so widespread across the industry. And everybody... it was becoming clear that everybody was moving between freelance contract staff and permalance on this, like, very musical chairs basis.
Right.
And so I was sort of, you know, speaking with some of my friends who, like Stella mentioned, happened to be a lot of writers and editors. And it's funny, we've addressed how sometimes it feels a little cultish, you know, but once you've seen the effects of collective bargaining in a workplace, it's hard to think of anything else, right? It is, it's not the only solution. It's not everything, but it does so much. And so, yeah, so a group of us who knew each other from Writers Guild primarily started meeting to discuss, like, how, if any, similar protections could be applied to freelance media work. And then, yeah, like Estella was saying, the meetings grew. We started bringing in more people and realizing, too, because we knew there were so many overlapping efforts going on in different industries, but seeing how many overlapping efforts were happening even within our industry and being able to bring them together, to start talking to each other, to find out how this shared history that I think we were aware of had a totally new application. And that's when the National Writers Union came in, because they have traditionally been a union that's both like an open shop. It is open to anyone who pays memberships, but has been quite focused on writers, right? Like authors, journalists, you know, like some copy editors. It was a big deal when they accepted their first photojournalist a few years ago. So in many ways, this is, you know, a departure for their membership structure. But in other ways, it is very much honoring the intentions, which was to, like, fully address the chaotic industry at the moment when it was most in need of change and of radical action in the face of, you know, a Republican administration, a hostile Supreme Court, all of these things that we couldn't possibly relate to in our present time. So, yeah, so I think having it framed as digital media workers, there are some like differences for sure, but the parallels are so strong that it's been wonderful to see how an existing institution can be, you know, brought into this contemporary moment.
Yeah, that's so well put. I mean, because you do need to adjust for the times, and like if we don't adjust, then, you know, the managers and capitalists will just worm their ways into whatever they can. Like, they will pit different types of workers against each other. And so that's, I don't know, I kind of wanted to open with that, because it's important we don't allow, like, you know, folks to just get all replaced with, like, a different type of worker.
Absolutely. And this has been something that I think media has struggled with for a really long time, specifically in the way digital media has been undervalued and exploited by, you know, publications that didn't value it as much as they do print media. But at the same time, I just speak for myself here, obviously, but I certainly do not think it is a coincidence that as soon as digital media started to reconnect union efforts with their own work, the same way that print journalists have for so long. So many digital media publications started really going hard on the layoffs and the buyouts and pushing people towards these freelance positions, these permanent positions, in an effort to keep the work as precarious as possible.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it seems like they have already, you know, like, capitalists, if we're just going to bandy about terms here, like, it's already been so effective the way that they sort of pitted every worker across all fields against each other by sort of eliminating as much staff positions as possible. And it's like, we're already seeing that change, and now we're having to, like, completely restructure also the way that we have, like, the ability to afford support to people. I don't know. I guess this is, like, ringing the bell of, like, portable benefits to me, which I've been, like, digging into. It's sort of a creepy thing, actually, if y'all want to hear the story.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's this guy, Mark Warner. Look at the, I'm just going to say, look at what a politician that is. Yeah, so this is the American businessman who's responsible for, like, penning the legislation on portable benefits. But a lot of the conversation around it is like, we can't possibly put any regulations on the market. Like, we're going to see it, and it's just, like, flat-out acceptance the way that the messaging is working. They're like, why would we try to turn the clock back 50 years to the way that the market used to look when we're clearly seeing that freelance is the future and, like, gigging is the future, and you're just going to have 3 or 4 jobs? Like, and I just think it's, like, it's kind of, I don't know. Is that weird at all, like, when you're trying to restructure what benefits are afforded by unionizing, or, like, knowing that we're going to be, like, more increasingly atomized?
I mean, I have some thoughts, but, yeah, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, I think one of the things that stood out in one of our meetings over the summer with the Freelance Solidarity Project, when we were making a lot of sort of decisions about what our next steps would be, what the future of the project would look like, were these bigger picture questions about benefits, about structural changes to the economy, to the work marketplace. And, you know, some of the conversations that stood out started with, like, well, how do we ensure that all freelancers have healthcare, like, that they can afford their healthcare, that they, you know, that they have coverage? Like, I haven't had coverage since March, right? And it sucks. And I'm always like, oh my God, please don't let anything crazy happen, because I'm relatively of good health. But but yeah, so one of the questions was very basic, like, how do we ensure that all members, that all workers and all freelance workers get coverage? And quickly, I mean, within a half hour of discussion, the question became, well, how do we fight for universal healthcare so that this isn't a thing that individual groups and individual gig economy workers and individual unions are fighting to figure out how to make sure their members have access to? And then, you know, again, we were then able to sort of apply this methodology to a lot of the other questions that were being brought up about benefits as freelancers. You know, how at this point in time, we're expected to have 3 or 4 jobs, piecing together all sorts of different paid gigs, and doing all sorts of random things just to pay rent.
And it's so delicate, right? Like, because if you earn too much, then you don't qualify for Medicaid.
Right.
And
which,
like,
is that's exactly always the case.
That I've run into the same issue where it's just like, you're uninsured until, like, you can prove to the state, like, no.
Right. And I'm like, actually, I didn't have any work in June. So, like, the paychecks that you're considering from May,
so bad.
Like, I have to stretch over the course of, like, 3
Meanwhile,
months.
Meanwhile, rent goes up and up and up, and it's like, well, so why is this means test? It's not, none of this is necessary.
Right. And so that brought us to, well, how do we fight for universal rent control? so that everyone who works in the city can afford to live in the city, right? So, the path from individualized questions of benefits and access to basic things like healthcare, like housing, became this broader picture of like workers are no longer like entitled to these things. I mean, we really have never been entitled to these things under capitalism. And so it was really a much broader structural question of like, well, what sort of role can we play within the National Writers Union, within the larger gig economy, within the larger labor movement to change the way that the system is structured, to change the way that all of it is structured, right? Not just pay, not just benefits, but everything. The fact that, you know, we're running out of clean drinking water, that, you know, cities are collapsing, like all sorts of things, right? So like it was just not that big of a leap to start here and end up there. And it was just really like phenomenal to see how quickly we could get from these individualized questions to larger structural ones.
That's really a fascinating line of inquiry. I'd love to hear more about what your groups found through that questioning process of like where you find your agency or like where you find you're like able to affect structural change by like collective, you know, like voicing yourselves collectively or.
Well,
I mean, because it is, it's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm totally, that's cool. So you guys all got together and you're like, oh, I want to focus on like affecting change on a larger scale. But was there anything that you discovered like a path of action through that? Or like, is that sort of the next step?
Yeah, a path of action. That's a good question. In the meeting that Stella is referring to, I think about that moment all the time because it really did feel like there was a before that meeting and an after mm-hmm. that meeting where it just clarified so much for us. And it was Kelly Stout, who is a WGA council member and also a freelance writer and editor, who phrased it so beautifully as we were going around these questions, where she was like, so do we want to abolish freelancing or do we want to make freelancing good? What is the path forward here for us, not as, you know, people who are just trying to live our lives and not be crushed under the weight of how much everything is bad, but like what's the end goal? And honestly, obviously that has been the driving force of all of our work as organizers, and I'd never heard it put so succinctly until that moment, which just does, you know, mm-hmm. to show how the more attention you pay to something is not necessarily the best way to understand it. But yeah, like since then, I think we have thought really deeply about the broader social movements that we have to connect our work to in an effort to avoid getting stuck in these like very transactional ideas of what a union or what collective organizing should bring to us, right? Because everyone should have healthcare now. Everyone should be able to afford the place they live, the food they eat. Like those are emergency questions that have to be addressed. But I do think we've been able, or like I hope we've been able to find the type of like calm that is not opposed to urgency, that trusts we're working towards a future in which more is possible, that it's not just these like urgent crises all the time. In terms of a path of action, we are at a funny like literal transitional period. We have this transition committee that's supposed to be taking it from like a volunteer collective into something that's more formalized, that's elected. So there's an organizing committee. And those people will be responsible for either suggesting or taking the suggestions of the membership into something that has like a year-long action plan and then like a longer-term action plan. Yeah, I hope that's not an unsatisfying answer. It's just, it's so hard to know.
I've seen a lot of like the freelance solidarity folks like at other actions that aren't necessarily related to their direct jobs, right? And that's very inspiring to me to see people pop up at like different rallies or tenants groups or like these sort of things, whatever it is. It is create like within New York, I think, creating a very interesting group of people because freelancers are kind of flexible, who can like mobilize.
It's true.
These interesting
We're just at home or whatever. Yeah.
The freedom to make your own schedule.
Oh my gosh.
And, we can abolish that one.
And like, Stella, you were saying before that you were involved in a lot of different types of labor groups, and I know you were part of a study hall, and like, I don't know if you want to talk about your other groups, but before you joined Freelance Solidarity, or
So I was briefly the community organizer for study hall for about 6 months, just kind of helping to figure out what the members were interested in doing. There was a lot of like social events that we put together. People just wanted to sort of meet each other because we're so isolated from each other, in specifically as writers and editors. You know, for example, as a freelance stylist, I have to work with people on set, so I'm not as isolated. But when I was doing more freelance writing, you know, I'm corresponding with people via email or text or whatever, and very rarely am I in the same room with them. And so I was with Study Hall for about 6 months, helping them to bring together some of their members here in New York and Chicago. But prior to that, I've been organizing both in labor and grassroots, like community activist work, for a number of years. I think I was telling Haley this during our roundtable, that I really like cut my teeth during the Chicago teachers' strike in 2012, where, you know, it was the first time in 25 years that the teachers had gone on strike. It was 25,000 teachers and 5,000 like aides and nurses that were striking for not just better pay and better contracts, but better conditions, because their demand was that the conditions in which they work are the conditions in which the students learn.
Yeah.
Right. And so there was a lot of hurdles and a lot of obstacles to their campaign of like trying to get community, not just support, but involvement. And, you know, at the time, Rahm Emanuel was mayor. He's like poster boy for like neoliberal.
Literal scum.
Yeah. Like totally literal scum. But, you know, he was Obama's like right hand man. And obviously Chicago is all politics and corruption. And so he did a really,
now
really
he's
great,
a great op-ed writer.
And now he's a great
op-ed. You're gonna let him in the union.
He's not allowed.
He's the only member we're gonna like, actively turn away.
I don't think of a lot of op-ed writers.
No, actually.
I'll take that back.
That's actually an interesting question. Like, are you gonna have cap offs? I'm sorry.
No, we don't have to.
We haven't gotten there
totally
yet.
All that.
Let's hope it's like a self-selecting membership.
Right. But yeah. They're going to be like, oh, these people seem too radical for me.
Yeah.
Also, though, they are going to, you know, they're really going to, I think, stay. Those who don't like labor and labor rights and workers' rights are probably not going to want to join a union that's trying to, you know, do this.
Maybe you could force them to pay the highest tier.
Bare minimum.
we'll get back to you. I did a lot of work around the teacher strike, and it was a lot of community seeing the teachers as part of the communities. A lot of the questions were about parents were concerned that if my kid isn't where they're supposed to be, which is school, from the hours of 8 to 4 p.m., and I don't make enough money to afford childcare, I'm going to have to take a day off from work, which means less pay, which means, you know, a snowball effect of things that we need, you know, our family economy. Mm-hmm. And Rahm Emanuel was, you know, banking on the precarity of the majority of the working class families of Chicago to pit them against other working class families of Chicago, mm-hmm. which were comprised of the teachers. And so a lot of the work that we did with the Chicago Teacher Solidarity Campaign, which I'm super psyched, just reformed like a month ago in Chicago. And so I still get all of the emails. And I got an email from the Chicago Teacher Solidarity Camp saying, like, come to our first, like, meeting in 2 years. We're reforming. And I was like, aha, a total, like, blast from the past. But, yeah, you know, I remember our first meeting, about 120 people showed up. And we're all just like, what? Like, we just put out a call. Like, if you're interested in supporting the teachers union during their strike, in any capacity, like, come to this meeting.
That's so
we
awesome.
Had people.
Did you have a big enough building?
We did. Luckily, we were like, we were using this big, like, church basement. So we did have a large enough space because it was a big church, but we really didn't anticipate 120 people at the first meeting. And every meeting after that, was between 50 and 100 people in attendance. Mm-hmm. And we were having at that time, like, weekly meetings because we had a church group committee and a student committee and a parent committee and a labor committee. So, you know, union members from the postal workers or the nurses union, they were coming together to figure out how their unions could support the teachers. I mean, it was, like, amazing. It really was, like, an amazing experience. And then from there, I went on to do a couple more, like, community organizing stuff. And then I did a brief fellowship with the AFL-CIO in Portland with the United Food and Commercial Workers, sort of just strategizing ways to organize newer, like, millennial workers who are in the most precarious, like, conditions that we've seen, right? And so... So it was interesting to work with a lot of younger people who, you know, who'd never been in unions, but were actively thinking of ways to bring unions back, and how we could do that in the current climate. So that's some of my background, with organizing. And, you know, I think what's exciting about the Freelance Solidarity Project is that we're really reclaiming what it means to be a worker. I think for a long time, those of us who were writers in some capacity, and then those who haven't been writers, who haven't ever worked as a writer in any capacity, tended to see writers as not workers, right? Like, or really any sort of artist. Like, if you get to make music for a living, or you get to make paintings for a living, or whatever, that you're somehow not a worker because, you know, work is supposed to be, like, grueling and miserable. And if you're, like, you know, jamming and that's how you make your, like, living, that you're privileged. And, you know, in some ways, yes, you are. Like, it would be amazing if everybody could do the things that, like, make them feel connected to their humanity and to other people. Yeah. But also, there are so many jobs that need to happen in order for societies to function, right? Like, we need people to make food and to care for each other and to, you know, build things. And all jobs should have integrity, and all workers should make a living and be able to sustain their families and have time of leisure and enjoyment to enjoy their life, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I think has been really exciting within the Freelance Solidarity Project is for us to reclaim, like, it's actually not a privilege to be a writer today. It's kind of a punishment. And if you keep doing it and if you keep going back and, like, pitching despite the low rates that you're, like, you know, it's not self-flagellation. It's that, like, we believe in the craft and that it's...
It is a service at this point.
It is.
It's almost... Because at the point where we have such, like the hegemony has such a stronghold on the way that we experience the world now, and the way that, like, the majority of our population is, like, understanding even, like, the movements that they could be, like, attaching to and, like, strengthening themselves with and, like... Instead, we're seeing it as, like, people who are directly advocating for workers' rights are having to do it all, like, for free.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, completely invaluable. It's just, like, the most necessary work.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane.
Yeah. And, I mean, being able to connect what we do back to a larger labor movement and reference, you know, projects and movements that came before us that were led by writers and were led by creatives that were aligning themselves with miners and with plumbers and with teachers, like, you know.
I mean, we've watched them turn, like, freelance gig work into a way to disrupt other types of union jobs. So it's like it's a key component of, like, giving all of these other types of freelance workers, like, similar protections. Like, we were just talking before we recorded about California passing this law that's supposed to reclassify gig workers. And it's Uber has fought back saying that they actually aren't primarily a cab driving company. Yeah.
They're trying to say that they're like, oh, well, we're just like a platform or something. Like,
yeah. Yeah, they're just a digital media platform. And, you know, digital media is not unionized, so.
Yeah, but that's also, like, California is one of the key places where, like, the portable benefits movement is, like, taking hold because there's so much disruption in, like, the classification of what we consider work and, like, how we tax things. So it's like we're just totally accepting, like, Haley, you were saying, do we want to abolish freelance or do we want to make it better? It's like, it's almost to the point where we don't have an option to abolish it because everyone has agreed that it's just like, there's no way to fight these companies. It's like, we have to just have some sort of,
I mean,
like,
it's such, net. We're at such a really, like, not to get too depressing, but it's like, we have I mean, we have, like, taxi drivers self-immolating and, like, like, all of this, like, this was, like, a job that was so necessary to our city for so long, and then suddenly the rug is pulled out from under it. It's a huge deal, and, you know, we can't allow there to be any type of, like, industry that gives companies a model to like gut and exploit their workers even more. So I see it as an entirely necessary piece of to revive, like, a much larger labor movement, like with teachers, with care workers, with all of these other industries, you know, like with things like Walmart and Amazon being, like, the biggest employers, like, in a lot of places.
Did you all see that news that a bunch of Whole Foods workers just lost their benefits because it was like, oh, we've decided that, you know, part-time doesn't deserve any benefits anymore. You just aren't, like, enough of a part of this company to be treated like a human.
And they know they can get away with it because people need the work or whatever.
Like, yeah, but we have some friends, the Whole workers who are fighting back against that. But it's interesting, like, to see that, you know, it's food retail, but it's the same sort of thing that's happening with, like, you know, intellectual, emotional, creative labor as well, like, all across the board. They just want to prove that we're expendable at some point.
Yeah, we can't be a chink in the armor. Like, there's no, like, we, this is, like, an invaluable thing, I think. Like, and I think everybody should go to their website and read the thing. I was, like, going through the application process. It's kind of long, but it's really interesting. I don't know if you guys want to talk more about any feedback you've gotten from people trying to apply, any like frequent concerns, like, that maybe stop people from applying all the way through.
Mm. Well, yeah, I was going to say, to your point earlier about the way workers are pitted against each other, something that became, like, a pretty common refrain in a lot of our early meetings was that we were trying to avoid having freelancers just turned into scabs by the fat of the industry. And so that has come back as a question about the membership as well, because a lot of people who started, you know, with us when they were freelancers have since gotten staff jobs. And then some people who have staff jobs have either been laid off or decided to leave for freelance or gone into different types of work. So it's always a question of, like, does our work qualify? And for sure, there are so many advantages to being a part of a union that is quite specific to the work that you do, because, of course, bargaining is going to be the most effective when everybody shares the same concerns. But for something like the National Writers Union, I think it's so incredible that we can be a little bit more open and inclusive to determine a new way of classifying the workers that make up the digital media industry. So most of the time when people are like, oh, does my work qualify or would it be weird if I was there? I'm just like, no, like just sign up. Like nobody cares. Not that nobody cares, but like just go for it. I think those concerns are really valid. And we have come up against, as you know, as we're still figuring things out, we want to make sure that the space is as open as it possibly can be in a way that doesn't preclude honesty, right? So there is a question sometimes about like, well, what if there's an editor at a publication where a freelancer has been treated poorly or, you know, like something along those lines? We are going to have to find out a way to address those issues.
You're thinking about maybe putting in some sort of robust, like, grievance sort of
yes,
process.
We have had, we have provisional bylaws right now. We were joking about op-ed writers before, but that wasn't not something that was on our mind. Like, what if a writer wanted to join who, you know, really embodied everything that we're fighting against? Who are we to say no to a dues-paying member? But that is sort of, I think, a moral responsibility on our part to be like, I don't know. It's a very thorny question that I don't know how I would put it succinctly on a podcast. But yeah, the question of membership comes up a lot. And I would say that this is the best possible stage to join and to trust that together we can find the best solution. Again, because I was so lucky to be part of the organizing and bargaining committee of MTV News, one of the most instructive things that the organizers of the Writers Guild told us was like, you set the terms of the bargaining unit before you sign the card. It's up to you to decide the company can fight back. And I know that's something that a lot of the art workers have faced with like, you know, different museums trying to determine who's management and who's not in an effort to weaken the unit. And that's like a horrible fight, but it is an instance of worker power where you can say, no, we're in this together. We know our work better than anybody else.
That's a great answer. And I've also heard that, you know, you can join multiple unions.
Of course. Oh my God, please join every union that you qualify for. Why not?
Because IWW has a similar one. Yes. And it's just like, read through them and see which ones you think make sense for you or both or multiple.
Absolutely. And yeah, the IWW's history is similar in that it's something that you can draw so much strength from in this present moment. And as a union specifically for freelance journalists, that's incredible. I know they've been doing their surveys to find out what freelance journalism specifically is like at this moment in time. And if you can afford to join both, like, and you're not a freelance journalist specifically, you can join ours, you can join both and participate in many different forms of organizing. Another bias, but I think it's a really good time to be a media worker in search of a union.
Absolutely. And I think the biggest thing that I like remind people when I'm talking about the Freelance Solidarity Project or really just labor organizing in general is that the members are the union, right? And that gets lost so often as unions have, there are still some large unions and there's tons of like labor bureaucracy that exists and corruption as we're seeing in the media lately.
Yeah, we're going to reference.
Right.
And UAW.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, which, and UAW is our international. The National Writers Union belongs to the UAW, the Northeast region. And so that is something that we as members have had to sort of start to consider and discuss, you know, what does that mean for potential new members who are like, well, I just saw this thing that's happening in Detroit at the like headquarters. Yeah. Like, how does that affect, you know, the national?
Where are my dues going to go?
Right. Yeah. And that is a very, like, those are very real questions. And what I always, again, what I always bring the conversation back to is that ultimately the union isn't this, like, body of people who provide you, who bestow upon you services and resources because you're paying, like, you're not paying a membership fee like you would to a gym or to a co-op. You are, you're paying member dues as a union member and you are part of, you are the union. Like, I don't care how good or how bad the leadership is. At the end of the day, the rank and file is the union. And it can become very distorted in, you know, in some cases where the union bureaucracy is gotten so big and so corrupt that the members feel powerless and so disconnected from their union, right? And want nothing to do with it or don't participate in actively and really just, you know, reach out if they do need to file a grievance or something's happened. But otherwise, it's like they just completely ignore that they're part of a union. And I know so many people who are in unions like that. And it's unfortunate, but those can be turned around. I mean, I think one example, and again, like I'm close to this example, so I'll bring it up, and I always bring it up. But the Chicago Teachers Union went through a period where it was very bureaucratic, and the rank and file did not feel connected to the leadership. And it was a process of like 13 years or something to educate the rank and file membership, 30,000 people, and get them to buy into their union again. You know, they're already paying the dues, but it's like to buy into being an active member of the union. And eventually they voted on a new leadership team that were all, you know, quite progressive, and were able to lead them through this strike in 2012. And I think they either just went on strike or they're going on strike again for a new contract. And so, I mean, I think that's an example of how you can take back your union, but it has to be very deliberate and it's not going to happen overnight. You know,
it's good to bring that up. And yeah. It's also because if we don't learn, like that took 13 years, we need to cut that so many times and make that happen faster if, like, when these things pop up more, and we need to be able to recognize when it's happening faster. And it's because we just don't have time.
Also, just have the fortitude.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's precisely like what Haley was saying. Right now is like the best time to join the Freelance Solidarity Project arm of the National Writers Union, because we're in our nascent stages. You're going to be part of that team that is giving shape to what we ultimately want this project to be able to do within the National Writers Union. And within the National Writers Union, we get to also determine what the UAW in our region does, you know, and if there are things that are happening that aren't in line with our values or what we think our contribution should be to the labor movement, we can say that as part of a local, as part of a respected, like, local, right? And so it's like, now is the time to join so that you can actually, like, really, like, get your feet wet and start to learn all these things so that when we actually do have to take this and be like, we're going to take back the UAW region, like, we'll be prepared for that, right? And, you know, and we're not 30,000 members yet. So now is the time to, like, bring these ideas and reclaim what it means to be a rank and file member, and that ultimately the rank and file membership is the union, not the leadership.
Mm. Yeah. So there's, like, an option to grow with this new, like, fledgling movement, and an option to say, like, kind of what we need from our experience as workers and what we feel our work is, and like we're able to then like make demands directly if it's at this stage or like.
No, I mean, I just think it's a because it's the beginning, there's a lot more options available as to which direction we're going to head in right now. Mm. Right. I think ultimately we always want to be flexible and as effective as possible in the work that we do. For the rank and file, and when I say we, I'm not talking about, like, the current transitional leadership committee, but just, like, we, like, big W, we, as rank and file union members, like, we who are actively participating in the work. So, I mean, if you join in 3 years, great. If you join tomorrow, great. Like, I think ultimately, though, if you're really interested in expanding what the gig economy worker can do within the labor movement, which, you know, even last year, if you were a gig economy worker in any capacity, whether you're a caviar delivery person or a rideshare driver or a freelance journalist, even a year ago, you just felt like, well, I'm piecing together all these jobs while I wait for something that I can, like, actually survive on, right? And then you see that, oh, it's been a year, oh, it's been 3 years, and I'm still piecing together all of my pay. Wait a minute, maybe this is just how it's going to be for the foreseeable future. Yeah. And it's clearly not sustainable. And so might as well just start now doing whatever organizing we can do. And maybe, you know, like, things are fluid. Maybe in a year you will be a staff writer, or you'll be in a completely different industry. And that's totally fine. But I'm sure that the contributions that you'll make to the work that we're doing now will certainly, like, be of value to everyone who's, you know, involved in it.
I'm inspired.
I feel really good.
Yeah, I just feel good. I feel like signing up right now. I feel like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like,
I
didn't complete my application. I have to go back and do it.
Oh, no.
I got overwhelmed.
We can pause this right now. I brought my laptop.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, I'm really thinking about it, though, because it's like, like, everything that you're talking about, it just hits so close to home. And, like, the experiences that I've been having, like you're saying, just that it's, like, piecing together work so much and then just feeling like, oh, wait a minute. Like, having that slow dawning realization also occurring in my own life where I'm like, oh, my God, I'm just going to be doing this. Like, it's not, it's so bizarre because I'm really, like, sinking into the mud of that realization of, like, wow, it's just gig after gig, and I work on a project basis. So when a thing is done, it's like, I'm not sure what I'm going to do next. And so everything also has to be like, oh, I have to, like, maintain this good worker attitude and, like, hope that somebody else hires me, and just, like, word of mouth, everything's chipper, and, like, totally above board. And inside I'm just like, I really don't know what's going on here. So, like, I don't know, just having that silver lining and just having that, like, real emotional kind of core to it makes it real for me. And, like, yeah, I don't know. I'm excited.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the different, you know, the options that we have really are to finally accept that, right? Like, I've been in this precarious roller coaster for 3 years, and I'm like, oh, wait. And I wake up and I'm like, this week I'm going to finally land a job with benefits and with, like, a living wage. And I've been saying that to myself every week for the last 3 years. And I'm like, wait a minute. This isn't, like, an intermission while I figure the next, like, you know, career move out. It's like, this is now my reality because everything is shifting structurally so volatilely, like, all the time across all industries. And I'm like, oh, so the options I have are, like, to just feel really, really, really shitty on my own and pretend for the sake of getting new clients that I'm okay and that everything's fine. And it's, like, the meme of the dog with the coffee in the burning house. And it's like, this is fine.
Oh, my God, totally.
I mean, that's all of us.
Ryan North, is that who made that?
I don't
know.
Green.
I don't know who that is.
Casey Green. He's a cartoon. I we have to know these things because, like,
So thank you. Finally, I know. But that I think that that's every, like, gig economy worker, and, like, that's the reality. That's the gig economy worker is the new face of the American worker.
And like we were saying, like, people, you get the staff job. Like, cause, like, okay, so I did freelance for 4 years and I get the staff job, and the staff job's terrible and has all these problems. And then you try to unionize the staff job, and then the staff job lays you all off. You know, that's a very common thing that happens to a lot of people. And so it's like, you do the groundwork now, because, like, even if you do get the staff job, there's no stability in that either.
It's kind of crazy too when there are creative fields that don't have a possibility of entering into a staff position, like,
right,
the things that I work on, like, it's literally, it's just like, oh yeah, I can make that, like, I'll build that thing, or I'll, like, draw that thing, or yeah, just having, like, also, like, a plethora of skills and being like, wow, I don't really know what the classifications for things are anymore, because people will spend so much time going like, no, sorry, like, that's fine art, and that's an illustration, and that's a comic, and that's, and I'm like, well, like, okay, but I just want to get some food, like,
right. Which I need, you know, and I've been talking a lot, so I definitely want to hear more about what you have to say, Haley, but one of the, like, wow, I just totally lost my train of thought. Just like now, it, like, totally, like, evaporated. Like water.
No, you're fine. Wow. Do you want to pick up? Or...
Oh, well, I was going to say, as you were talking, I was thinking about something that an organizer we know, Ism at the Writers Guild, also has said in the past, which is that you don't, I mean, I hope I'm getting this right, but it was something like you don't change institutions, you change people. And mm-hmm. I think to your point about like you freelance 4 years, you don't have a staff job, you lose a staff job, you go back to freelance. Like that's part of so much of what we're trying to address, which is that we're now witnessing like another generation, which seems crazy to say because it's only been 5 years since Daughter unionized. But I am meeting people now who are entering their very first jobs in media in what is a mostly unionized workforce. Right? There are more places to look for jobs that have a union in place that have already negotiated one or more contracts, which was not the case when I entered media. And just for, you know, myself personally, as an example, I hope I get into trouble. I don't get into trouble for saying this. But I'm like, you know, I'm old and Canadian. I remember what Vice used to be like. You know, I remember the do's and don'ts, the I Love Cops.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Street Carnage.
Please shit on Vice. It's my favorite thing. Oh, yeah. I don't want to cut this at all.
No, I remember there were a lot of, there have always been good people who have done good work
right.
for publications
totally.
Like Vice. It is just an example.
Yes.
And Vice is obviously still a very fraught workplace. But when I see our friends and our coworkers who have fought so hard for their contracts and continue mm-hmm. to fight outside of what we consider to be traditional labor organizing just to protect themselves and the people that they work with, it is like, the word I want to use is unbelievable, but it shouldn't be, right? It shouldn't feel like such an incredible leap from what it was. But the fact is that it is. Like, and in just, you know, the 10,000 years that I've been on this planet, I have seen so much. And I feel like we are going to continue to see such truly radical shifts within existing institutions. It is like, you know, oftentimes, I know we're sad, we're stressed, it's the apocalypse, like things are bad. But there's also the capacity for really shocking changes for the better. I know it's very Pollyanna, but both things can be true. I'm deeply terrified of the world we live in, and I am, you know, in a good mood about it sometimes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of hope in collective action and like realizing that we haven't lost the planet. We haven't lost our human rights. We haven't lost anything. We just need to feel the agency to be able to craft a future where we better understand the ways of like taking care of resources and taking care of each other. Like,
yeah, and extend that outside. Yeah, because like, you know, the people who have like maybe lost their homes to climate change, or the people who have been deported for bullshit reasons and like whatever, yeah. like we extend that to people, and that's like what collective bargaining and solidarity like promotes in people's brains.
And protecting media workers who are able to bring this kind of information to a place where we can like, okay, well, I wouldn't know what was going on if we didn't have such a wide and diverse network of media workers. So it is incredibly valuable, again, like that we support this industry, and especially if it's people who are freelance and who are like following their own beats and who are like...
And it helps dissolve some of the elitism. I know with like the art worker stuff, people have brought this up a lot when they write about like the museum workers unionizing, where like the bus drivers and the fire engines that when they do an action, like mm-hmm. like it feels good to be more connected to other workers and not just in this bubble of like we work at an institution or whatever.
Yeah, no, everybody celebrates workers getting together. Yeah. Do you want to plug anything? Do you have any projects coming up, or
do you have any articles you're excited about?
Well, I'll definitely encourage everyone who can to join the National Writers Union and to select Freelance Solidarity Project when prompted, because I think we're going to do some very exciting things together. And I'm excited we have a roundtable together that's going to be published on the new entry
soon. Oh my god,
soon.
Thank you. I meant to bring that up before.
That's going to be exciting. And talking to Dana from the New Museum and Catherine from BAM. Anything else that's going on
the horizon.
My like brain went totally blank and like,
well, you were on it the whole time.
You were holding that perfect amount of information.
Yeah, I have no idea. It's just like I was mid sentence and it's like, oh, I nothing to say. One of the things that I did want to say did come back. And you know, it's that one of the things that is one of the many things that is very exciting to me about the sort of core group that we have, and surely the new people that will be joining it, is the balance that we've been able to strike between like focusing on like what are tangible things that we can demand and campaigns that we can like start to organize and build around, but also like not losing sight of this bigger picture stuff, like, you know, how do we join the fight for universal healthcare? How do we join the fight, you know, against climate change? Like, as, you know, a freelance solidarity project, part of the National Writers Union, like, how do we do that? And one of the things that you brought up earlier or just now about how supporting us helps us to put out, you know, produce the content that people want and need to know about what's going on in the world, I think that's one of the like really, really important things that doesn't get talked about enough. I think when we talk about the Freelance Solidarity Project with people that are curious about it, you know, generally we're talking about like we're advocating and fighting for our rights as workers. We see ourselves as part of the like broader labor movement, but also like what's the impact of what people are able to access, like the content that they're able to access? How does it suffer or how does it benefit based on our work conditions? The same way that the teacher said, you know, our work conditions are the conditions in which your students learn. This is really the same case for us. The working conditions of writers, and largely at this point, most of the content is being produced by freelancers. How do our work conditions shape play a role in the sort of content that people are able to access now? And especially as media companies are, you know, driven by profit most things are driven by profit or in most industries, but where the content, it's all either sponsored or ad driven, you know, all of it is shaped around that. If we have rights to organize and demand the things that we need to survive as writers, as media workers, then we're also able to influence what the media landscape should look like, how we can actually democratize the industry of information and knowledge and who has access to it and who can produce it. Like, we're able to play a role in the democratization of that, you know?
Oh, so well said.
Get me so stoked.
Well, thank you so much, Stella, and thank you, Haley, for joining us on Art and Labor. We will link to Freelance Solidarity. We will link to your Twitters, and we'll link to our Patreon to keep doing this podcast. We have a Patreon, and people can support us on there because these platforms collapse. Like, we were on Drip, and Drip mm-hmm. collapsed, and it's mm-hmm. the last week of Drip. And then after this month, there'll be no more of that. So, so support us and support the freelance solidarity and support
and support yourselves by signing up.
Yes. Oh my gosh! Thank you again. And let's have fun, everyone.
What's up?
Thank you for having us.
If you have an aeroplane that can fly the world and we can have a fantasy, it doesn't matter if you travel. You drive for galaxy. I really don't care if you just drive a truck. I don't care if you just drive a limousine. It doesn't really matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care because I just love your company. Let's have fun. 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 Lots of fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun, lots of fun.